Hi, welcome to Visual Studio Toolbox. I'm your host, Robert Green, and joining me today is Billy Hollis. Hey, Billy.
Hey, Robert. Good to be back.
Thanks for coming on the show again.
I'm happy to do it.
Billy is the man who needs no introductions, but we'll introduce you anyway. Famous author, speaker, XAML expert, UX design mentor, and you're here this week for the VS Live conference.
That's right. I did a workshop on Monday, which was kind of an entry point for developers to learn how to do modern app design, learn some of the principles and the processes they're probably not familiar with. And I did two sessions yesterday, one which was particularly well received on how you use some of the capabilities of XAML to do better UX, because XAML is just an amazing technology. Yeah. It has all this wonderful stuff in it, but if you don't kind of flip on the parts of your brain that think to use those parts, then you don't necessarily get all the goodness out of XAML when you do a new product out of it.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit today. I was listening to you fairly recently when you were on .NET Rocks. I think I was weeding at the time, which is not a fun thing, but your conversation kept me interested. And you said that you were talking about data visualization and the way you present data in XAML and how if people were doing it in a more visual way, presenting data in a more visual way, you were seeing customers who were discovering that they could get their apps to be much more useful and do a much better job of not only presenting the information, but enabling people to make sense of it.
Yeah, the idea there is, because of the way our technologies have kind of pushed us for the last 20 years, people use a lot of the what we sometimes call the wall of data grids design, which just puts all the data there. And from a functional perspective, it's very flexible. But what that requires your brain to do is spend a lot of cognitive effort parsing through textual and numeric data. Right. And the idea being that in this highly graphical environment we have, we can leverage some parts of the visual system in the brain that the wall of data grids doesn't, by taking some of that information and turning it into something that is visually very quickly absorbed. And that has several advantages, one being that people are more likely to see relevant information, and they do it faster because the visual system operates on an unconscious level without having to think. It's also less fatiguing for people to look at data that way and let that other part of the brain do it. I sometimes talk about the visual system, its ability to see shapes and process certain things like faces and smiles, as it's almost the GPU to the conscious mind's CPU. That if you're parsing down through a data grid using verbal abilities of your brain, then that's kind of the CPU. And we all remember the old computers that didn't have a GPU.
Yeah.
And certain operations that were graphically oriented were very slow, because there wasn't hardware optimized for that. Well, we have hardware optimized for seeing things in our environment. That's just a matter of the evolution of the species, is that in order to survive, we have certain capabilities to see things and recognize things very quickly. So if you can leverage that in your applications, you can make users more productive and generally happier, as well as take away a lot of the training. Because a lot of the stuff, as we'll see in some of my examples, are so obvious. When the app just kind of draws you in and makes it obvious that you don't really need any training and you don't need to think very much about it.
Yeah, cool. Let's see some examples of that.
Okay, yeah, let's bring up one of these. This is one of my starter examples, and it's not a real one, but it's inspired by some of the things that I did real applications based on. And it starts off with, people are kind of used to one of the applications that I worked on, the StaffLinks application, which you've seen the video of and lots of people have. I fudged up a navigation shell for that, and that's just the platform by which I start. So this is an example of one of the things I bring up in that. This is a typical sort of contacts set of data in which you might pick somebody and see the detail over there. But instead of picking people with a data grid-ish kind of way of looking at things, we use a data template. Now, most people in the XAML world are familiar with the idea of a data template. They know they can lay things out, but it's fairly rare that you would see somebody do something like this.
I think that that a lot of times you use a data template, and a lot of times I use a data template. This is nothing more than display the rectangle in different colors and get the text closer together.
Right, and you might vary the text size a little bit and some things like that. And that's kind of,
I want the name to be bigger and bolder.
Right,
but it's not a grid per se, but it's not that visual.
It's not
just
that visual.
Colors.
It's an improvement.
It looks prettier.
It is an improvement, both aesthetically and cognitively.
Right.
It is an improvement over a grid, but it isn't going nearly as far as the technology allows us to
go.
So this is an example where we go a little bit further. In this case, for example, perhaps some of our contacts are physicians. Mm-hmm. So the data template now includes some shapes over there. I usually refer to an area in a data template that takes pieces of information and reflects it into shapes and graphics. I call that a badge.
Okay.
And I don't know that that's industry standard terminology, but I don't know what else to say, so I just made up my own term for it. So that's a badge there that reflects a couple of pieces of information right now. It reflects whether somebody is a physician by the shape that you see there. If we scroll down through the list, you'll see various people have that symbol that indicates that they're a physician. And that's a lot better than some checkbox or flag or something that says they're a physician. And people don't necessarily have to think very much about it, and they don't have to be trained. They see that little shape, and that shape says physician to them. You can also see that the different badges have different smiles or frowns. Mm-hmm. It turns out that there is actually a little index, and when I hover, you can see it. That's a satisfaction index, and I've just fudged that up, but you can imagine that being derived from various pieces of information about the contact. So that person has a minus 73, this one has a plus 87. I'm going from minus 100 to plus 100.
Okay.
But you as the user don't need to even know what the range is or anything else. You're just able to look at the thing and get a general idea about whether somebody is satisfied or not. So we know that Ralph Cramden is a physician who, in our contact list, who is not happy.
Right.
And we know that Liza Doolittle down here is very happy, and she's one of our top 10 customers, but she's not a physician. And we get that very quickly and intuitively. And as we scroll through the list, we can scan that badge for visual information much, much faster than we can parse text in several columns of a data grid.
Or put various rows in different colors. So physicians are blue, happy physicians are pink.
Pink, yeah.
Top 10 customers who are unhappy physicians are brown. Next thing you know, you need 15 to 20 colors to figure it out, and then what color is what?
Yeah, you've got all those combinatorics.
Yeah.
And the uptake on that, the intuitiveness of it, is not nearly as high as you'd like to be.
Right.
Not nearly as high as something like this.
Yep.
Now, these sort of things are actually not very difficult to do. The shapes that I use, such as that physician shape, there are a variety of XAML-based graphical shapes available out there. One of the packages that you can get a lot of shapes from is from Sync Fusion. They have what they call Metro Studio. It's
Metro
one of their free
Studio.
Products. Do you use Metro Studio?
Yes, I do.
And you can just go in and have a little search function, find the thing that you like, and it will spit out the XAML that will do that shape. And that's what I did for that physician right there.
And
I did not write the XAML for that.
Up and down for you.
That's the beauty of the vector graphics.
Yes.
If I'm doing my shapes in XAML, then that means that no matter what size I put them, they will just dynamically scale for me.
Yep.
And then I did the little top 10 thing with just a little rectangle, some translucency, et cetera.
Okay.
The translucency kind of makes it fit because that's a little bit too big, and I don't want to make it opaque.
Yeah.
So doing this kind of thing isn't very hard. As long as you're prepared to think about what XAML does and use what it does in some creative ways. The magic in XAML is that you have all these capabilities available, and you combine them in interesting ways. So for interesting, the smile. How do we get the smile to change in relation to that satisfaction?
How do you draw
index?
The smile in the first place?
Well, yeah. How do I draw the smile? It's a semicircle.
Okay.
And it starts as the highest up smile that I can get is my semicircle. But then I can apply a scale transform to it that can, you know, a scale transform can actually flip if it goes negative.
Right.
So what I'm doing is taking that satisfaction index and turning it into a value for a scale transform.
Okay.
And the negative number will get me a negative smile. So I'll show you the actual
and then the only
value
one has
converter
to know
that does
the
high
that. And small of the range and have that memorized is the developer.
That's right. So let's see if we can't get up to, I guess I should have to stop this in order to get to some of my stuff. But I'll bring it back up in just a moment. If we go to... I think that's over in my contacts views, isn't it? So that would mean that my activity to there it is, like index to smile transform converter. Okay. See that little guy right there? What he basically says is he implements iValue converter. Let's make this full screen so you can see it all. Yeah, well, there it is, full screen, full screen. Yeah, okay. Shift Alt Enter. So we go to full screen and we can see all of the code here. And there's a little conversion function that I use there. But the two things that implement iValue converter are, and most XAML developers will be familiar with this, convert and convert back. What I'm doing is taking that value in, which I know is between minus 100 and plus 100, mm-hmm. and I'm dividing it by 100 to get a fraction. And then I don't want it to be zero, because that would cause the smile to completely collapse. Okay. So if they're neither satisfied nor unsatisfied, somewhere around zero, I'm going to take that range and turn it into something that I can actually see a little bit of it. Mm-hmm. But other than that, basically I am returning a value for the transform based on whether that on that like index or that satisfaction index. I'm taking the minus 100 to plus 100 and turning that into a plus 1 to minus 1 for the smile.
Okay.
And then that's just a typical converter parameter, or rather a typical value converter, but that's not the sort of thing most developers would think to use a value converter for, to use a transform to make something look like a smile. Now, the thing about it is, a lot of people would look at this and say, isn't that kind of cheesy? Because if you look at something that's got smiles on it like that, is that the sort of thing that people will consider, I don't know, immature? And actually, no, they don't. Developers, I think, tend to be a little hypersensitive about things like that. The brain is optimized to see smiles. Mm-hmm. So you might as well leverage that capability.
Yeah.
And as long as you're not trying to get too exact with your faces, there's no eyebrows on this.
Right.
I'm not trying to make this so realistic that it does look cheesy.
Yeah.
It's just enough to show it's a face, two eyes and a mouth. That's really all I need. So as long as you keep this sort of thing fairly minimalist, mm-hmm. You don't get over into the cheesy territory.
But it's also the kind of thing that you can discover in UX testing.
That's true.
You show three different versions of this: one with smiley faces, one red, green, yellow.
Maybe eyebrows.
Yeah,
eyebrows that would show that they were more negative.
Yeah, or
that they were upset.
Square. Those are blockheads. We don't like them. Triangles.
Yeah.
Right. Those are pointy-haired
exactly.
bosses or whatever.
So you could, and I encourage this in my UX design classes, that when people have a problem like that, to think of three or four ways to
right.
solve that problem, and then take that out to the people who will help you zero in
yeah.
on the one that's best. But to get to there, you have to not be afraid to do things that are a little outside
right.
the normal application
really fancy,
box.
You can make it a setting of the app.
That's true.
I could choose what to use.
And I'm actually going to show something about that here for data templates
cool.
in just a moment. So I use that value converter in a data binding so that in that the template that uses this, there's a data binding that makes that smile work. I'll show you that template. That's the doctor template, and that is in my local resources. I've taken my templates and put them into this this dedicated XAML file,
mm-hmm.
so it's kind of easy to. I've got several different templates for my contacts, so I can look at them. Let's go down to the one.
Do you find that better than putting the templates that are used in a particular view in with the view?
It depends. It depends on how many templates I have and how widely used they are.
Right.
So I may be using these data templates in several different places, so I don't want them necessarily going to view.
Right.
And I've also got several related templates that I've also got several related templates that only vary a little bit. So it's easier for me to group them together in a separate place
okay.
and kind of work on them all at once.
Okay.
So in this case, I just created a little XAML file to do that. And so if we look at where that smile is being implemented, we go down here and find out that there's the ellipse that draws around the face, and we can see that the grid that holds the part that's got the little symbol for the doctor, there is a property named hasMD,
mm-hmm.
and a converter that takes that and either makes it visible or invisible depending upon the value of that property. That's a Boolean. So there's a Boolean to visibility converter that
yeah.
will flip it on if the person has an MD and flip it off if they don't. This down here is getting into the territory where, although I'm sorry, that's the physician thing. Going down a little bit further, we'll get down to where the smile is. That's the top 10 thing. And now we see there's the grid that is working on the like index. Mm-hmm. And using, you can see right here, there's the scale transform for a path. That's the semicircular path. That's the scale transform to it. And the scale Y is taking that like index and using that smile. It's a resource. It's one of those, it's an instance of that converter that I just showed you. It's taking that and turning the like index into the transform, the scale Y transform value, which will make the smile either compress it, mm-hmm. gradually compress it as it goes down in positive. When it flips to zero, it will flip it into a frown, and then the frown gets bigger and bigger as you get closer and closer to minus one. So that's the sort of thing you can do in a data template. A lot of people just don't think to do.
Cool. So if you scroll back up a little bit, that's just a little bit more. That path data, that is drawing the doctor.
That is drawing the doctor.
But you got all of those numbers from Metro Studio.
That's right.
You didn't have to sit there and figure those out.
Exactly. And I don't want to figure those out because you look at this.
Yeah.
You do not want to be figuring these numbers out.
Right.
So go to one of the libraries, and Metro Studio is always my first stop, mm-hmm. Because it's right there on my client machine. There are also a lot of web resources for XAML icons. Yep. So yes, that path data there, I don't want to be writing that.
Right. Somebody drew that doctor.
Some very nice person at Sync Fusion
spent
a lot, probably an hour or two one afternoon getting that just right in his graphic tool.
You created that, and then you can take the XAML, copy it, paste it into your app, and next thing you know, you have a doctor.
I have a doctor shape.
Right. Okay.
So that certainly leveraging those resources is one of the things that the typical developer doesn't think to do.
Right.
They're a little bit intimidated, I
don't know anybody's going to sit there and do that.
I'm not going to.
I'm
way too lazy to do that. Another aspect of these data templates is that you might need to vary them depending upon what different classes of users might mm-hmm. need to look at different things. You might also need to vary what people are seeing based on where they are in some kind of task flow, that they need to see the data with this representation, this visualization in one case, or at one stage of, mm-hmm. of the processing, and something different later. So one of the things that you want to do if you do want to leverage data templates, is make it easy for people to switch between different ones. Mm. Because once you have one of these data templates, it's relatively easy to make a copy of it and do some variation on it. Add a field here, subtract a field there. This gets us out of a problem in traditional applications where a user comes along and says, oh, I absolutely have to have access to this piece of information right here. So you just have to put that on the screen. Yeah, but if I put it there and now it's cluttering up the screen for everybody, mm-hmm. 99% of the people don't need to see it. Nevertheless, for that one guy to have it, it's there for everybody. Right. Well, we need to kind of get past that way of looking at things because in the data template world, you can take the data template most people use, make a copy of it, add that one thing that mm-hmm. guy needs, and then make it some kind of configurability option for that data template to be used. Or you can just have a list of data templates and let the user pick the one that they like.
Exactly.
And I actually have that here. You can see that there is a drop down over on this part of the screen where when I drop it down, I see that I have several different data templates that are available to me. I have four in this particular case. Hmm. So that if I just need a very minimal view of the data, I could pick the data template that has the minimal view.
There's the classic data template.
And there's
nothing
more than sizing and such.
And colors and size.
But there are users that are maybe casual users that notice that allows me to get more names on the screen. Mm-hmm. So you might want something fairly brief because you're scrolling through a very long list looking for a name. So that template would serve for that purpose. Or we might have this here where maybe it has to do with how much money are we making off these people.
Yeah. Okay.
So we've got some symbol that indicates something about whether they're very important from a monetary mm-hmm. perspective.
And then do you typically put a data tip? I saw you had data tips on one of those that would then actually display the information.
I typically do because a lot of people will key in what may see a symbol, even no matter how intuitive you make the symbol.
Right.
A few people are going to wonder, does that really mean what I think it means? And a small number might even be confused. I don't understand what that means.
Right.
So having the ability to put a little tooltip up. Of course, the problem is in our touch-based apps, we can't really do that.
Yes.
We don't really have the hover. So right. It's a nice optional capability for desktop apps. I don't feel like that you have to have it, because if you've done a good enough job with your idea generation in the design phase,
right,
and you've gone through a good evaluation phase for people to tell you what really works well, then it should be intuitive enough that it just brings people in without needing those kind of crutches.
Right.
But it's easy as pie to do, so it right. doesn't hurt to have that on there.
Right, because somebody might look at John and Irene and see that they're both dissatisfied, but want to know, are they the same dissatisfied? Is one significantly more dissatisfied than the other?
Right.
So, you know.
And I think this template doesn't have it, because this template has the generic thing there, and you can actually see the numbers. On the other template, I actually did put the actual index as a hover over the smile.
Right.
And I could have put some text that said,
yep,
this customer has a satisfaction index of minus 66.
Yes. Yep.
So I like for people to use this example as kind of a springboard to think about what kind of visualizations do we really need for our data that will help the user see it in a way that is natural to them. This one, though, is really intended for the single list data, where you've got a set of records and you're not really that worried about child records.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going to go into more complex hierarchical data structures, then you have to extend your templates a little bit further, and I have an example of that, so I can show that next.
Okay.
Let's put that down and bring up the different Visual Studio. This was an idea I came up with for a client that was doing some transportation stuff, and the data is just normal data. It's there. I stuck it into a data grid, and you can see there's various pieces of information there that you would expect to be just exactly the sort of stuff that a data grid would contain. So that's the raw data, and that is not actually very far from the way a lot of people would just stick it on the screen now, is it?
Yep.
But let's compare something.
And not
like
that far from the way a lot of users would demand they need to see the
data.
They
would think, they would say that they needed to see it.
I need to see all of the information. I need to be able to scroll between all of it.
Yes. And the interesting thing about that is that users will keep saying that until you show them something so much obviously clearly better that they see it and they go, I got to have that.
Right.
So your objective is to do something so good that you wrench them loose, because there's a principle called status quo bias.
Yeah.
And that expresses that natural resistance to change that users have. And you have to understand, existing users,
if it broke, why fix it?
Right. But it's even more than that. That's part of it. But existing users, for them, the existing system, no matter how hard it is to use, well, they've already climbed that hill. It's a sunk cost to learn to use that difficult to use system. So they don't necessarily take into account the cost to the business for the new people coming in. And they don't necessarily understand either how much more productive they could be.
Yep.
But what they do understand is the system is hard to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they can't easily replace me, can they?
Right.
So you have to understand that there are certain biases in the users, that they want certain things, and that has to do with their own self-interest as opposed to the interest of the business. So while I am a complete advocate of users, I really think that we don't listen to them enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think developers ought to go out and listen to users more. That doesn't necessarily mean that the user is always right.
Right.
There are certainly situations in which their judgment is biased in a certain direction that isn't the best overall direction. So we take this kind of information and say, no, we don't want to do something like that. Suppose we do something more like this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a data template again, where we're using part of the data template to do some of the stuff you talked about before. We're using some of the visual stuff to highlight pieces of information.
Yeah.
And we use things like even italic, so that you kind of learn, your visual system will key in on that italic if you learn that that's where the ID number is.
Okay.
Because you need the ID number for certain purposes.
Okay.
The italic will help draw your eye to that in a record like this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another example of using the visual system instead of people having to search and find the right column for something. So that's one aspect of it, is, and we could put as many information there as we needed. But this particular set of data, that flat view of the data didn't really show us that there's a lot of child information going on here. In particular, if this is going to be a transportation thing, then there might be stops that the shipment makes. and we might be very interested in what's going on with the stops. Well, in the typical data hierarchy, that stop will then be expressed internally as a collection of child records. Mm-hmm. And the typical grid exposure way to expose that would be you hit some little thing and some more gritty looking records come up, which is, don't you think that's just ugly and hard to use?
More, yeah, it's either more grids or you leave that grid, you get a pop-up dialogue or something. Yeah. Now you've lost context.
And so, to me, data templates completely solve that problem.
Yes.
Without very much work at all, if you take a little bit of thought about how things ought to be exposed. So, for instance, for the stops, let's say that we've got different kinds of stops. Well, we might want to display some kind of summary. It doesn't have to be text. Mm-hmm. You could imagine that a trained user would know that a triangle means a certain kind of stop and a circle means a different kind of stop.
And I would also assume that the ones on the left are where the thing started, the ones on the right are where it's ending up, and
that's
the
natural.
Grade
yeah.
ones have been completed.
Exactly.
And so I can now kind of
and if
see
I go down
things are.
To another thing, what
red,
do you suppose?
That's probably bad.
That's probably bad. That something's going right. on there, that maybe something is overdue. And maybe the yellow means that it's marginal. Okay. So those kinds of things tend to be very intuitive,
yes.
and now I can scan and find something out much more quickly right. than parsing text
and
in
I
a grid.
And I can tell that the fact that the first two are red, not grayed out, means that it hasn't gotten to the place it's going, but there's a problem when it gets there.
Yeah, exactly.
As
yeah.
opposed to it's left the place where it was, and now there's a problem.
Right, so you start
to... all that information I get, and I don't even know what this is.
You didn't even
doing.
Know. You've never seen this before. How could right. you possibly know that, Robert? You have not been trained on this application. How could you possibly know that? Yeah, that's the
Because I know what grayed out is,
you know
and I know green, red, yellow, and it shouldn't take that long to learn what the various...
And so if we're going to expose it at a summary level, mm-hmm. we might still want to see the details. Well, data templates allow us to do that.
Yep.
There's nothing to keep us from putting inside a data template for a list box another list box. Mm-hmm. So in this case, there's the overall list box that contains the master records.
Right.
And inside the data template is another list box that contains the stops.
And for this, you're not doing anything fancy. You are showing the graphics, but then all the rest of it is just text.
It's just
data.
Standard data.
Right.
Now, I might, in fact, depending upon what the user needs to know after I've studied their situation, I might make the data template for that internal
yes.
list box quite a bit more sophisticated
sure. mm-hmm.
because there are multiple levels of visualization that I work on.
Right.
In this case, for this quick example, I just kind of did that top level of visualization,
right.
and I might design several ways of looking at that data and show
yeah.
them all
you
to the users.
You might just need to know, oh, for that yellow one, where is that and who do I call?
That's right.
When was it due? Who do I call? That's all
when
I need
was,
to
yeah,
know.
Exactly.
Yep.
So supply the level of detail that you need, and that can pop up and down on a record-by-record basis mm-hmm. in a way that is natural and gives the user exactly what they want. Similarly, we might have issues that people need to worry about, but... that nothing appears over there unless we have them, and if people want to see them, then they can pop that down and find out what the problem is.
Okay.
And just see what that is. And again, it's a case of that's another list box with a data template, which means that when I pop that down, I can put as much rich detail as I
yep.
need depending upon the circumstances.
Right.
I might again have a situation where different data templates were used for different users in different kinds of situations. Even on the interior parts, mm-hmm. I might vary the data template that was used. So that's kind of an example of moving people away from this grid mentality, because I think if you took somebody who really thought they wanted a grid and you gave them something like this that had the information they really liked
yeah.
in a way that was this accessible, now they all of a sudden, they don't care about the grid so much anymore.
Right.
Especially if it's a situation where what they're primarily doing is finding a record that they need to work on. Where the grid shines more so than this, although you can make this work, the grid that by default typically has cell-by-cell editing, and that is something that there are certain kinds of business processes where that cell-by-cell editing is needed for flexibility.
Right.
But even there, we have taken this kind of a design and said, all right, if you reach a point on a record where you need to do some editing, part of the pop-down will be the little data entry thing.
Yep.
And now I've got an optimized data entry experience for exactly that step in the process.
Right. Or you can take that grid, move it out of the way, bring up the edit form, and then when you're done, swap that out, bring it back.
Bring up a child form, but it depends a lot upon the nature of the editing they're doing, how complex it is. If it's very simple editing, I might very well just want to have a little expandable area in the template for them to do it, put some editable fields right there inside the record, and not have to go to the trouble of a child screen. For something more complex, I would probably pop up a child screen.
So how often do you find it difficult to convince the user that they don't actually want the grid? I mean, you can't... The grid's just showing data. It's not... There's information in there, but it's just showing data. I mean, if you think about it.
Yeah.
And the purpose of this app is... If the purpose of the app is to admire the data, fine. That's a pretty simple app to build. You just make a data grid and you make the numbers as small as possible so they all show up. But in all likelihood, that's not the purpose of the app. The app is to find information and then do something.
Do something with it, yeah.
Right?
Well, probably the best way to answer that is to look at some real situations that I ran into where I had teams for which both the management of the group and the users were psychologically completely committed to data grids because they couldn't imagine an alternative. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to understand some of the psychology here. Users assume if you make a radical change to the system that you will break it for the purposes of them getting their work done. They just assume that.
Why would they think that?
Why would they think that?
Why would anyone in the computer industry think that ever?
Yeah, that's I don't blame the users for thinking that. Right. And they also have this mental bias to think that if the information isn't instantly accessible, I don't see it, I won't be able to find it. You will have hidden it somewhere that I cannot find. So they have those preconceptions that drive them to the data grid. The data grid shows everything.
The other thing they would also potentially think is if you change something, you're doing it because you're solving somebody else's problem.
Yes.
Not mine. Oh, I didn't have that problem, but now it's entirely different.
Yes. They assume that when you change something that much, you're going to cause a lot of grief for them.
Right.
That's what gives them a lot of their status quo bias. So how do you get off of that? You show them something that matches their workflow so well that as soon as they see it, they have to have it. Mm-hmm. And believe me, you take something like what I showed here, I mean, that's just the beginnings of an idea. If you can imagine refining that and targeting it at a particular set of workflow well enough, you put that in front of people and they'll forget that they ever wanted data grids.
Right.
But it's your responsibility as the designer / developer to come up with something that fits their workflow
and that lets
so
them
well.
Do their job better.
That's right. And as soon as you do that, they'll release what they thought. That team I talked about that was just sure they wanted data grids, and in fact, I had to really pound on the developers to get them out of that mindset. But eventually they did go to something not dissimilar to this and with the pluggable pieces for data entry because the workflow was fairly complex. And as soon as they showed it to the users were much, much more happy and satisfied with that than they were the data grids they had before. But you have to show the users that you can do better before they will believe you can do better.
You have to prove it, right.
So don't go in expecting the users to be enthusiastic proponents for this approach. Until you actually show something that matches their workflow, they will not be.
So is this difficult coding to do? Do you have to be a UX design, a UX expert in order to do this?
I don't think so. But certainly, as you can tell, a lot of the data templating stuff that you're seeing here is completely the sort of stuff that you're already doing.
Okay.
That even somebody that's doing pretty much a very minimalistic way of programming in XAML would probably understand how to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
So that just isn't much of an issue for the majority of the stuff that's on here.
So
now,
how did the shapes get done?
How did the shapes get done? Yeah, let me mention a couple of things and then I'll get to the shapes.
Right.
So you can imagine this thing over here, that's just an expander.
Sure.
It's an expander inside the template. Since the template automatically sizes, see, this is another bias developers come into this with. They assume they have to set the size of these items.
Hmm.
One of the things you have to get past is that you don't normally want to set the size of the items. You want dynamic layout, what the web guys call responsive design.
Mm-hmm.
You want the items just to size themselves. That way, when you put an expander in there, when it expands, the item just takes up more room.
Right.
So but those things are not very difficult, XAML. It's just kind of learning to think that way. But even the stuff with shapes isn't that bad. Let me show you the thing that does those shapes. Let's see, there's the stop collection to graphic converter. That's that's, I think, the value converter that's taking that child of that collection of children and then turning that into the shape. So how is it doing that? Well, it says, I've got these stops. You can tell right there what's coming in here is a collection of stops. And I want to reflect that out as a graphic. Therefore, what I do is I create the container, the graphic that I need. In this case, it's just a simple stack panel.
Can you do that in a converter?
Yeah, of course I can do that in a converter. Cool. Did you not know that? No, the converter has access to all of the XAML namespaces.
Okay.
So I can just do whatever I want to in the converter, manipulating visual elements. So in this case, I get a stack panel and tell him to be horizontal, give him a little bit of margin, and then say, all right, I want to go through the stop collection. For each stop in the collection, I'm going to look at the stop type. If it's a land stop, I'm going to build a triangle for that. And I just build a triangle. I declare a triangle as a polygon.
And if you don't know how to do that, you can go do a search on that. And there's people out there who have done this.
This is the sort of stuff that a coder can just pick right up. It's just the object model of the visual elements. So the object model of visual elements says, to define a triangle, I need to put some points in. The stretch property has to be stretched to fill itself properly. Let's get the, what color should it need to be? And I have a function that's going to take the status and turn it into a brush.
Okay.
So that's how I get the fill right there. And then set the height and width and the stroke so that I've got a little bit of outline. And there's where I set the tooltip to give a little bit more information if I need some. And then once I've got that shape, I just go to that stack panel, his children collection, and add that shape. Now, the stops are then just going to stack themselves
horizontally. So is the converter returning the stack panel?
It is. Now, after I put one in, I do need a little linkage thing. So if I'm not at the end, I'm going to create a little bitty rectangle and use that rectangle to be the connector between the two stops.
Okay.
So I'm stacking triangle, little connector rectangle, circle, little connector rectangle, etc. Those things are getting stacked horizontally to as many of them as I need. See that? I don't know if you noticed this, but the number of stops vary.
Yes.
And this thing takes that into account. It builds a shape for each stop, and then when I'm completely done, I just return that stack panel.
So what's the view XAML look like?
Let's go back and take a look at that. The data template for that, let's see if I can't get to the window that's got that. I think that's in main window. Are you in main window? Yeah. So you can see that there is the list box. Mm-hmm. Let's get rid of this so we can see it. There's the list box that is, let's see if I can't manage to get this guy out of the way. There's the list box that's containing all that stuff. And there's some demonstration items that are going in there. And here is the data template. The item template for the list box looks like this. Let's go to full screen so now we can see that data template. View, where's my full screen at?
You gotta be in the code.
Oh, I do, don't I? Yeah, down here. Okay, view. Where's my full screen?
Oh, you can't do that.
I can't.
You gotta use these.
I gotta use those guys, I guess, yeah. Let me just make me some more room there. All right, that should be enough. So you can see that the data template starts with a grid, and there's the light goldenrod yellow. That's where that color's coming from. And if we start looking down through there's several columns. The first column has 110 width. That's where those shapes are going. Now, I could make this more flexible under various circumstances. This being more of a prototype demo thing, I did not. So in that first column, there are a couple of rectangles there that are, that's what's filling that little, I don't want to put a rectangle around the item, but I do want a little bit of a separator.
Okay.
So I don't know if you noticed this or not,
yes.
But when I started, you see that there was that thing there and that thing there, those two separators. That's the rectangles that are doing that. And then we've got a stack panel. Let's see, which stack panel is that for? That's the one that's got that information. And then there's another stack panel that's got that information. And then over here, that's the place where we've got the stack panel that's got the shape stuff in it. So right there is a content control. Right, and the stack panel is just going to slide right into that content control. So the content is bound to the stop collection, the collection of stops, with a converter that is an instance of that advanced stop converter that I just showed you. So that's going to take that take in that collection of stops and spit back out the graphics to slide right into that content control. And then I have an expander below that with a list box that shows the detail on the stops if you want to see them. So there isn't really anything about this XAML that's wildly complicated.
Right.
It's just the barrier is not technical at all. The barrier is for people to learn to think in that direction. Because the magic in XAML, see, the mental model people have of most UI technologies is that they're dragging big chunks of functionality out of the toolbox and then manipulating the properties of these big controls that they put on the visual surface. That's not really the XAML philosophy. XAML has a lot of fine-grained things that have very narrow responsibilities. And we see this typically in people will go to a stack panel trying to look for the border property when they first start in XAML. I want to put a border around a stack panel. It must have a border property, right? Mm-hmm. But you rapidly learn that's not the case. To put a border around a stack panel, you put it inside a border element.
Right.
The stack panel is stupid. Doesn't know how to do a border. The border is stupid. It doesn't know how to stack things.
Yep.
But put the two of them together, and now you've got both capabilities. That's the mental leap people have to make. Yep. This idea of combining things in interesting ways so that if I want these shapes in a horizontal stack to be a visual representation of the stops, then mentally I should think, well, it's a horizontal stack. That's a stack panel.
Yep.
And what goes in there? Shapes, rectangles and circles and polygons and stuff.
Right.
So once you make that mental transition that I'm taking these little bitty pieces and combining them in interesting ways, then that kind of opens up your imagination a little bit about how to do this. And of course, the other way to stimulate the imagination is to look at examples, advanced XAML examples, and figure out how they did that.
Yes.
Look at examples like this without me showing you and kind of stimulate your own thinking about how to do that. So that's why, for example, this integrates with UX design. In that I tell the teams I work with, as well as the developers I'm training to do it on their own, to never start their design with a electronic wireframing tool. Don't do that. Paper before pixels is one of the watchwords. Low fidelity, low investment. Sketch things out on paper. If you can sketch it on paper, you can almost certainly figure out a way to make it do that in XAML.
Right.
But if you start with the electronic tool, you tend to keep your mind focused in on what you already know how to do, and that what the tool is able to do.
And what you already know how to do, what you already know how to do in the tool.
In that particular tool.
Which limits you even further.
Yeah. So one of the key insights that people need to get if they're going to go in this direction is that little set of shapes started as a sketch on a piece of paper.
Right.
Not as me going into XAML to figure out what I was going to do. So you go through a process where you sketch out various ideas. The best ones, you then go try to implement in some kind of prototyping, wireframing tool. I actually use XAML for my prototyping just because I've done it so long that I'm really fast in it.
Right.
And advanced XAML developers should do that. Beginning XAML developers probably want to use like the wireframing tool in Visual Studio or something.
Okay. So how does this change it going from XAML platform to XAML platform? So in other words, WPF over to Windows 8, over to Windows Phone, and then ultimately if you're using the XAML tools, iOS and Android. The concepts, the goal is still the same, but in terms of the mechanics, how you implement it, how much of what you're doing here could only be done in WPF? Is most of it also in Windows 8? And then what happens when you're building the mobile version of this app?
When you go to Windows 8 or mobile, a lot of it is things that are taken away that you don't have anymore. For example, Windows 8 has no expander. So that means that some of my expandability and making regions expand and collapse as people need them is I either have to do a lot more work or I have to just design a different approach. Okay. But then on touch-based platforms, I have something that the desktop doesn't give me, which is the ability to quickly swipe and do context management by people swapping from one thing to another. Mm-hmm. So I might very well have a case where based on something that they've selected here, a quick swipe will get them more information.
Okay.
That interaction pattern does not work well on the desktop,
right,
but it works fine and touch-based applications. So we have to retune some of our design sensibilities to what the platform is good at. And the big barrier is touch versus non-touch. Mm-hmm. Certainly when you go down all the way to mobile, you're so constrained on space that you have to be fairly creative about how you do things, usually by reducing the amount of functionality. If I've got people who are looking at this kind of this rich amount of data to make decisions about transportation stuff, I'm probably not going to put that on a phone. I mean, I could, but I'm going to have to really reduce that down to the absolute minimum amount of data and probably take some functionality out. Now, on a tablet, I can probably do just about as good as I can on a desktop with a slightly different design approach.
Yeah, because you've got various form factors.
Right.
So whether you're on an 8-inch tablet or a much larger one, you'd have to decide. So would you just go to more swiping and more scrolling? I mean, you can, you know, on a tablet app, you can assume that the screen is this wide.
Right.
And then have not all the information fits immediately here, but if you swipe over, then you can see more information.
Yeah.
So you don't need the expander so much as you need a finger swipe.
Right. That's kind of one of the key insights to understand when you're designing for the two separate cases is, in a mouse-driven environment, people have low tolerance for horizontal scrolling. Horizontal scrolling is clumsy with a mouse.
Oh, yeah.
But with touch, horizontal scrolling is very intuitive
and
natural.
Unless you have one of those mice with the scroll bar.
Yeah, but you can't count on
that,
can you?
No.
So when you move to a touch platform, it turns out that people are far, far more tolerant of horizontal scrolling. So you want to lean on that quite a bit more heavily to get you more virtual space for your design. And whereas on a desktop, you don't want to be horizontally scrolling. Vertical scrolling is really all you want to allow, and that's there's kind of a natural mapping of, yeah, I've got this much data and I know there's more down there that I'm vertically scrolling to. Don't horizontally scroll on the desktop for the most part. There are exceptions in all design principles, but that's a good guideline to start with. On the touch platform, go to the horizontal scrolling to get yourself more room, but that's an interesting design challenge.
Yeah.
What should come into view when you scroll, and how do you signal people that it's out there? That's one of the more difficult things. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot of applications have the main client area in touch, and they show kind of a sliver of that's the visual signal. See, 10 years ago, we would have thought that was a really stupid design, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
If we put that on a desktop, we would have thought, were you sloppy and just chopped a piece off there?
Yeah, or the app's broken. It's only displaying some of the data on the side.
Yeah, exactly. We would have naturally assumed in a desktop world that there was something wrong with that.
Right.
But in the mobile touch world, having that little sliver over there is a useful visual signal that there's more stuff to come.
Exactly.
So you either have that, or maybe you have something along the top that's kind of breadcrumb-like, some sort of indicator that there's more stuff out there, some kind of context management to control what's going on in the horizontal direction. That's part of what you have to think about in design. And you have to think about the priority of the information. What do they see first? What do they see further out the line? And that all takes understanding the user's job a lot more intently, a lot more deeply than the typical developer does. The typical developer just wants to know, what data do you work with? I'm going to throw that on the screen.
Right.
But if you're going to do touch-based mobile apps, you have to know the prioritization of the data much, much more deeply.
Yeah, and if you're going to do a phone app, then not only do you have to understand the data, but now you have to even better understand the workflow.
Yes.
So when I, turn this on and look at the app, we've got this much information to see. Not all of that's going to fit. So what is the first thing
what
I
should
want to
I see first? Yeah.
And then what's the second thing I need to see?
Yeah.
And if I need to go swipe five times, is the app, how less useful now is the app, less usable is the app? It's going to require a lot more
UX
testing and a lot more figuring out how exactly people want to use the information.
But notice that some of the general principles carry over.
Yep.
That idea of visualizing that collection of stops is probably even more valuable on mobile than it is on the desktop.
Right.
Because I don't have much room. So if I can take that entire collection of stop information, collapse it down to something that's shapes and colors that are that communicate the data intuitively to people, then that's even more valuable the smaller the form factor gets.
Right. You may wind up also using a little bit more filtering. Here you've got a whole bunch of data in the screen and you're scrolling up and down. if in order to view customer after customer after customer, I have to swipe. By the time I get to the seventh or eighth customer, I'm kind of tired of swiping by that point.
Pretty much our standard design, when we go back to that very first example that I showed you with the list of contacts, our standard design is to have a filter at the top so that you can type in to collapse the list downward,
right,
and a drop down for sorting for the up to maybe half a dozen common ways that the user might want to sort that particular list. So that's certainly capabilities that you want to have. And I think we do that on desktop apps too, not just on mobile. But the fact that people can, because it's not just, I had three or four screenfuls there, but it's very common in production scenarios for people to inadvertently return 1,000 records or 2,000, and they can't scan through that. So they need a filter to collapse them
but
down.
But even at 25, I'm going to be less likely in a desktop app to automatically filter if there's only 25 records coming.
Because I can see just about all of them.
You scroll through 25 records with your mouse pretty darn quickly.
But on mobile, I can't.
On a mobile, I'm counting finger swipes.
Yeah.
And there's nobody. You're not going to get up to 25 before you're howling that the app's unusable.
Right.
So immediately there, you now got to start thinking about it.
Right. And you want to come up with good filtering mechanisms, and you want to come up with filtering mechanisms that are extremely touch friendly.
Yes.
Which means you'd really like to stay away from them typing stuff into the virtual keyboard for filter if you can avoid it. So that, the way contacts work, for example, people work on Windows Phone, where you press the letter and all the grid of letters comes up.
Yes.
And now I just go to a particular letter.
Right.
Something like that works a whole lot better on mobile than typing in
a smiley face, a neutral and a frowny face, right?
Yeah.
I tap that, I see everybody who's happy, sorted by happy they are.
Yeah, that would be a great filter.
So that's very easy to do the filter. I just tap.
Just tap to what you want. So those kinds of creative ways of visualizing and using the data and making it accessible, the typical business developer isn't trained to think that way. And if they start down the data templating path and using all the capabilities of XAML, then I think they can produce applications that will just make people more productive, mm-hmm. but will also, they look good, they're sexy, they make the users feel, we've got some savvy people back there producing stuff like this.
Right.
You start throwing out the usual 1990s era screens to people whose entire technology right now is their tablet and their smartphone. And then you throw a 1990s era desktop app at them. What's the emotional experience there?
That's a very interesting point, because your users, in all likelihood, have a smartphone.
Yes.
They probably have an iPad. We wish they had a Windows 8 machine, but they probably have an iPad.
Yeah.
They've got an Android. They're used to this already. And then they get to work, where work is not like that. You know, why shouldn't it be? It should be.
There is an unconscious psychological association that this software must be low quality. Look at this. It doesn't have the aesthetics. It doesn't have the interactivity. It doesn't have the intuitiveness of the stuff I use at night to change channels on my DVR.
Exactly.
So you guys must not have much on the ball if you produce stuff like this.
Right.
On the other hand, you produce modern apps, things that look good, but more importantly, the looking good will only carry you so far. Getting the aesthetics right will get you a good first impression, but it's just like you've met attractive people who turn out to be not very pleasant to be around. The attractiveness will get them a certain amount of benefit of the doubt, but it only goes so far. And the same thing is true of apps. You make it attractive, they are disposed to give it a chance, but it still better have the intuitiveness and the usability. It should match the way that they think about the work that they're doing.
Absolutely.
And if you don't have that, then they will eventually conclude that it's low quality, even if it looks good. So you have to have both. Fortunately, most developers can lean a little bit on the visual designers to get the aesthetic right.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the visual designers that I've worked with are no better than developers at the interaction design, at coming up with like the visualizations of those stops and things.
Okay.
I think visual designers will eventually grow more aware and acclimated to that. But a lot of them come from the web world, where getting the graphics and colors right is what's important, and they don't tend to think about visualizing data in certain ways. Developers tend to be just about as good at that as designers. So having a team, I love having designers on a team, by the way. I don't mean to imply that visual designers aren't a very valuable part of the process, because they are. They do get the aesthetics right, and they typically are a little bit more disposed to generate a lot of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Developers have this problem I call solution lock. that they have to overcome, which is as soon as they see one solution to a problem, they lock in on it, yeah. and they don't want to think about other solutions. Designers of any sort are much better at being expansive about thinking multiple ways.
As a developer, as you're designing the app, you can't help but think about, oh, how am I going to build
that? How am I going to build it?
How am I going to build that?
That's why I want you sketching on paper, to because that puts that further
even
away from
Even if you're sketching
me.
On paper, I'm still thinking, well, how am I going to build that?
Well, I think the key there is, and sketching on paper will help this. It won't necessarily take you all the way. But sketching on the paper kind of engages a different part of your brain. It isn't the procedural analytical part so much.
Yeah.
So basically, if you can get into the right mode of creative thought, mm-hmm. then you've put your analytical brain to sleep a little bit.
Right.
And that helps a lot in keeping you from worrying so much about it.
Right.
And also the experience is, if you go through a couple of design processes and you sketch it out, and you might have to sweat blood to figure out how to make it work on the back end, mm-hmm. but it's high value stuff, so you do it. Once you see, yes, I can take the paper all the way through, then you kind of stop
right.
worrying about it a little
right.
bit.
But if you start with the paper and the design, then you're starting with, well, what would the user want to see? And then you think, well, how am I going to build that? And if you get to the point where, oh, I can't build that, then you can, you know, adjust the design as needed.
You can.
But if you start from the building blocks, then you're never, it's harder to get to the point of correctly coming up with what the user wants to see if you're just thinking, okay, well, I'm going to put a grid here because I know mm-hmm. how to do that, and, well, I guess that's going to be a grid. And
You're unconsciously optimizing for your needs.
Yes.
And not optimizing for the user's needs.
Right.
Because that's where I kind of part ways with a lot of developers who spend, to me, an inordinate amount of time worrying about what makes things work well for the development team. Now, I understand that stuff's all important, all the process stuff that they love and such. But to me, that's all subsidiary to, do we produce software that makes the users happy,
right.
productive, less fatigued, fewer errors, things like that. If we're not putting that first, I don't understand why we're building software.
Yeah.
So that is one of the attitudes that people, if they're going to go into this world, they have to adapt to that. They have to be prepared to look at users, observe them in a very humble way, not going there to try to prove themselves superior to the users, but just, how do you do your job? What could we do better? Let me learn to get inside your mind so I know where your pain points are,
right.
and I will design stuff to address that.
And then go learn the mechanics, which is always a good thing.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you just showed us a bunch of stuff here that I think that anybody doing XAML should want to go and learn how to do.
Yes. And to know that it's possible is the first step. So if you're going to get into this world, you build your pool of stuff that you know is possible by looking at good examples and understanding some design principles about what makes the examples good.
Yep.
So you build up your pool of ideas, and then you don't necessarily, I mean, people could watch this video today and think, yeah, we might do that at some point. It might be 3 months before they, as long as they know it's possible,
mm-hmm.
they can do a just-in-time learning of how to do it.
Yeah.
But so knowing that it's possible is the first step.
Cool. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's all right, Robert. Hope this was fun for people, and hope they got something good out of it.
And so speaking of fun, let's switch gears a little bit, and why don't you tell us what your latest cool toy is?
Oh, yeah.
You were showing it to me earlier.
I can. I
we
did.
Have to share this.
This is new. Let me get this. This just recently went into beta, and I was on the alpha developer program, but couldn't talk about it until it into the beta stage a couple of weeks ago. This thing is called the Thalmic Myo, and it's an armband. You put it right up here on your arm, and it senses muscle contractions and finger movements, as well as having an accelerometer. So now you can imagine taking that kind of information and knowing that somebody's made a fist or snapped their fingers or done this, and then integrate that directly into your software. So unlike a Kinect where you have to face the camera and be at a certain, this you can, it doesn't matter where you are.
Uh-huh.
This works fine. Plus the fact that you could have two of them so that your logic could take into account information from both arms to decide how that was supposed to work for the interface. So you can imagine, you know, zooming and pulling out and such just with your arm. And I think this is a natural match for a lot of interesting things. The Oculus Rift, for example, you can imagine it feeding control into those kind of systems. But I immediately thought of healthcare applications, where, for example, a surgeon doesn't want to touch anything while he's operating, but he might have an MRI image that he needs to, you know, zoom in on this and show me that, and this thing could be the link so that he's able to, the user interaction mechanism by which he is able to specify what he wants. So this is pretty cool. This company is based in Canada, Thalmic Labs, and I think we're going to see a lot of activity of them out of them because their beta units are shipping now, and I think you're going to see a lot of interesting software.
Another good use would be cooking apps.
Yeah, because you don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You've just been touching raw chicken. Or you've got olive oil all over your hands, and now you need to scroll in the recipe.
That's a good point.
You don't actually want to touch your tablet with, you know, greasy, dirty hands.
And one of the original videos they put up has various clips of people using it. One of them is a guy cooking in the kitchen and looking at the video of how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he's just waving because he's got stuff all over his fingers. So that's an excellent point. So I would encourage people to think about that. That also kind of brings to mind something that I see a lot of people who want to, with the best of intentions, they want to say, look, our practices are to build with these technologies and do X because that's consistent. And I see this particularly in the HTML5 world. But the right attitude was expressed by Amanda Silver this morning in the VS Live keynote, where she talked about, look, circumstances vary. There are certainly situations where the reach is extremely important, and there are some great tools now to help the HTML5 go to various form factors. But sometimes you need access to native things, the device drivers that run things like this, at a level that's the HTML5 world kind of lags behind on that stuff. And so you should be prepared to look at the platforms and match them to what the users need, what the companies need, and not go in with the idea that we are doing all apps with HTML5 because that's the standard.
Rick Strahl had a very interesting blog post either today or yesterday about the mobile web and essentially, you know, why is it that we've got this HTML but it can't talk to the natively to the devices. And
you see some of the apps in the various app stores, and I don't know how you'd ever build them with HTML5, and some of them are enormously successful. So I think people who are going to be, especially out there on the leading edge and doing stuff like that, ought to be aware that the native platforms still have a lot of applicability. There's still a lot of places, and they're evolving in some respects faster than the HTML5. One of the points that Amanda Silver made this morning was that especially in the mobile world, the browsers don't really progress as fast as desktop browsers do because they're gated by the various vendors of the phones. So you have to be kind of careful about assuming that the browsers in your users' hands on the phones are actually going to have some of the capabilities you need. So it's a complicated, messy world.
Yes.
And often people come up to me at conferences a lot and they say, well, what should I choose? What can I do? And they asked the question in lots and lots of different ways, but if you strip away the non-essentials, what they're asking is, what's the safe choice right now? And the answer is, there isn't one.
You know what the safe choice is?
To know,
it's to learn and be able to learn new things.
To learn through things?
Yeah.
And one of the nice things about getting more into the UX space and understanding what goes on there, that stuff sticks with you longer. It applies longer because it's about things, about the way people think, about the way the brain and visual system works. How quickly does the brain change?
Yeah.
Not that.
The other option is to limit your customers to only people who are happy to have you build software in the tool you know and love.
That's true. And especially in the small to medium business space, that's very, very viable. That's one of the, I work a lot in that space as well. We have big companies too. Our main client right now is Xerox. But we do a lot of work in Nashville with small to medium companies. And some of the recommended ways of doing things with 6 JavaScript libraries for this and all these add-in, these small programming shops with 1 or 2 guys in these smaller companies, that's just overwhelming to them.
Yeah.
They can't learn all of that, plus all the Azure APIs, plus all the SQL whatever. It's just not really feasible for them to do it. So we also have to keep in mind that the optimal solution varies with that kind of circumstance.
Yep. All right. Well, we're done.
Thanks, Robert.
Thanks so much, Billy.
A lot of fun.
See you next time on Visual Studio Toolbox.